From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, Lake Effect's Bonnie North in Europe on a fellowship brings us an interview with a former Green Party member of the German parliament who was troubled by the state of populism in the country.
As long as the German majority doesn't open their minds and their hearts for the reality of being an immigration country, being a multicultural society, nothing will change.
Then Atlas Obscura founder Dylan Thuris talks about how travel can benefit our minds as well as spurring a spirit of adventure in all of us.
It sort of brings you back into present attention, which you lose in your normal surroundings. And so it's just the fastest way to give yourself that sense of focused curiosity.
Plus, we'll have the latest in our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next, after this news.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Lake Effect's Bonnie North is in Europe this month as a part of a journalism fellowship through the RIAS Berlin Commission. It's a program that exposes American journalists to the workings of European politics and media.
Bonnie has been speaking with a variety of sources in her time in Germany, from international and domestic journalists to policymakers. Bonnie joins us on the line now from Berlin, the former West Berlin, to share a conversation with a former elected politician. Bonnie, who is Özkan Mutlu?
Özkan Mutlu is a Green politician who had a seat in the Bundestag and no longer has that in the last elections. But he is still very active in the party and very much kind of a representative of his neighborhood of Kreuzberg. And Kreuzberg was the old West German area that was predominantly Turkish back in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And it still is very Turkish. They call it Little Istanbul. But there are a lot of other folks who have moved in as well, including people who trace their blood relations to Germany, you know, back decades. So it's one of those really wonderful sort of multicultural neighborhoods that used to butt right up against the Berlin Wall on the western side of it. If you walked along the wall, you could hear the East German guards back when there was still a wall in East German guards.
So this is one of these classic melting pot neighborhoods, and you would think that that's a there's the happy ending and everyone lives together in harmony. But he's pretty concerned about the rise of nationalism and right-wing politics in Germany, right?
He certainly is, and he's not the only one. Just about everyone that I've spoken to here, whether they are in the press or they're just people that we meet who actually, you know, have enough English, because my German certainly isn't good enough to have those discussions in German. But they're all concerned about the rise of the AfD, which is the far-right nationalist movement here. There was a poll last week. I think they are the second now most popular party in particularly in the former East, but in lots of other more conservative places in Germany. And they are, like a lot of populist movements, they are pretty much Germany for Germans, but they are not quite willing to go far enough to say who those Germans are. They are called a neo-Nazi party. People here are unafraid to say that. They actually call them that. They, of course, don't like that and try to distance themselves from it. But they are anti-Euro. They are anti-migrant. The 2015 migrant crisis here, particularly from Syria, really pushed them in the forefront. And that's what Mutlu is concerned about, and a lot of other people are too, that Germany already is a diverse society, and that people in the AfD are trying to push them back to some sort of golden age where there wasn't anybody else but, you know, blonde and blue-eyed Germans.
Well, and so your conversation with this gentleman starts with a pretty innocuous question.
Yeah, we had just finished lunch at this really wonderful old Turkish restaurant. He had given us a tour of the neighborhood, and I asked him if he wouldn't mind talking with us, and he said, sure, he would love to. And so we went outside to sit down where it was a little quieter, and I asked him to just give me his name and how he would like me to refer to him. And I was just trying to set a level, and he took that as a very serious question and just went from there.
This is an all-time struggle for us. Are we German? Are we Turkish? Where do we belong to, etc.? And this is a question which has to be answered not by the minorities, by the immigrants. It has to be answered by the majority. How do they see me? Do they accept me as a German? Do they believe that I'm one of them? If you look at the recent debates, unfortunately not. We are referred as passport Germans. Like, you have just a German passport, but you are not a German. That's the debate in Germany within the majority, and this is a big problem.
One of the things I remember from being in Berlin in the early 80s was the idea of the guest worker, the Gastarbeiter, and that Turks were doing a lot of the jobs that Germans did not want to do, but they were not part of the society. They were separate. It was a parallel society. Has that changed in 35 years?
I mean, we are not called guest workers anymore, but more and more we are called Turks. Even we live here in the fourth generation. My parents pay taxes for 50 years, but they are still referred as the Turkish minority. That is a delicate issue within the German politics. They don't know how to deal with all these millions of immigrants living here. Of course, we have the phenomenon of parallel societies. But why do we have that? Because these people are not accepted as Germans, as part of the society. So what do? They build their own infrastructure. They build their own society. They stay out of the German society where they are not welcomed. As long as the German majority doesn't open their minds and their hearts for the reality of being an immigration country, being a multicultural society, nothing will change. And if you look at what is discussed these days, having the AfD, a Nazi party in the German Bundestag, and the many state parliaments, if you look how they treat the AfD treats foreigners and refugees, we are far from the ideal being a diverse society where everybody can live side by side.
But here we are in Kreuzberg, which is an incredibly diverse part of Berlin where people are living side by side. So it can be done.
Of course. Kreuzberg is one example for successful integration. Everybody should look at Kreuzberg and learn from Kreuzberg. But if you would talk to German colleagues of mine, German, bio-German politicians,
People who were born here with German lineage.
With German ancestors. Okay. Born here, German ancestors, etc. German bloodline. That's why I say bio-Germans. If you would talk to my colleagues, they would refer to Kreuzberg as a failing example of integration. Because they have never been here. They have never talked to the people here. They never lived with the people here. In this place, you have people from all over the world. You have Germans, you have Turks, you have Greeks, you have Russians, you have people with Muslim background, Jewish background, you have Americans, you have Christians, you have atheists, and they live side by side without no problems. And this is a very quite safe place. Of course, we have problems. Of course, we have the headscarf issue. We have youth violence. We have unemployment. That's what we have everywhere. But here, you can be assured that no one kicks your ass because you're homosexual, because you're Turkish, because you're German. Of course, sometimes it happens too. But compared to other places, it's a quite safe place.
Why do you think the AfD, the AfD, has risen so much in the last few years? Why aren't Germans more willing to accept a multicultural society?
That's a very good question. I have no answer to that. The problem is the biggest supporters of the AfD are people who are from the bourgeoisie. You mean people from the who have money, who have jobs, who are wealthy. they are supporting the AfD. The loudest are the ones who are on the streets in Sachsen and Dresden, etc. But the main support for the AfD comes from the elite. So it's a contradiction. You know, these are the ones who succeeded and they believe the bullshit AfD is telling them. What is AfD telling them? Regardless of the facts, regardless of the figures, they are telling that the immigrants, the refugees and asylum seekers are taking our jobs. I mean, how stupid can you be? I mean, go to Dresden. The amount of people with foreign background living in Dresden is maybe less than 1%. Muslim population in the whole state of Saxony is less than 1%. And Pegida, which is the one of the main supporters of the AfD, was founded in Saxony. Pegida means Patriot Europeans against the Islamization of Europe. What the hell are you talking about? The number of Muslims living in Saxony is less than 1%. So what are you afraid of? So I have no explanation. Unfortunately, it's maybe in the nature of a human being to believe easy truth. And the easy truths are far from facts, far from reality. The reality in our country is we do need immigration, at least for demographic reasons. We are a society which is getting older and older. So we need all the young immigrants coming to our country, keeping our pension system safe and pay taxes for our elderly, etc. Everybody knows that. The fact is, immigration is enriching Germany. Immigration is not only culturally, it's economically, it's we focus on the society, is good for our country. And many people know that. But people more and more want to have these immigrants, these refugees kicked out, because in the nature of human beings, people always look for ones to blame at. They look for people to scapegoat, at scapegoating, etc. And maybe it's also strongly spread in the German society within Europe. You have trouble in France, you have troubles in Denmark, you have troubles in Norway, of course. But German is unique. Imagine a German politician in the year of 2016 saying the Holocaust memorial in the heart of the German capital is a memorial of shame. This is something no German politician would dare to say in 10 years ago. Nowadays, it's not a problem saying that. It's not a problem denying the Holocaust. It's, just a few weeks ago, we had in Chemnitz, a nearby town in the eastern part of Germany, we have riots on the streets. Nazis were running after refugees, the weakest in our society, screaming Heil Hitler, and the police was watching, and the head of the German intelligence watching these videos taped by some left activists said, this is fake, real videos taken at the street when Nazis were running after refugees. And the guy who was in charge for our security, who's in charge for our safety, said this is fake news. And this guy now is the special counsel for the German Minister of Interior. So that's Germany in 2018, unfortunately.
You spent some time in Wisconsin. I know you were in Madison for about 3 months. It was a little while ago, and maybe things have changed. But, you know, we're dealing with similar kinds, not necessarily the Nazism, but we're dealing with difficulty with immigrants, difficulty with the idea of undocumented workers, even though we need them. And so when you were in Wisconsin, what did you notice that was similar to the kinds of things here?
Of course, Wisconsin in 1989 and Wisconsin today is different. I lived in Omaha, Nebraska for almost a year in the early 90s. I felt as part of the whole. I didn't feel as a foreigner. I was studying, I was welcomed. People were open-minded and interested. It was a very nice experience. And I felt homesick to Germany in these times. But as soon as I came back to Germany and landed in Frankfurt, all of a sudden this homesickness was away, because the police officer at the border showed deliberately to me that I'm not a German. I'm a passport German. So how can I feel home? I'm a German member of the parliament and I serve the people. I fight for equal rights against discrimination. I feel German. I dream German. But as long as the majority doesn't accept me as one, I can do what I want. And that was the biggest difference between the U.S. and Germany, I felt these days. But today, Germany and U.S., I don't know. I mean, Trump, as president of this plural democracy, it's a shame. It's a shame that people like Trump and parties like AfD get stronger in our democracies. These are the enemies of democracies, and they are abusing our democratic rights to come to power. And the first thing they do is get rid of democracy. And this is something what happens in many autocracies, in many countries where dictators got elected into office and then destroyed democracy. We had that already. We had that in 1933 when Hitler was elected. He was elected by democratic votes. But the first thing is he did was to get rid of the German Reichstag at that time. So therefore, we Democrats have to be very, very careful. We people who believe in equal rights, humanism, human rights, all the values our ancestors fought for, we have to stick together and fight these anti-democratic movements all over Europe, all over the world. Nevertheless, the countries US or France, where Le Pen is getting stronger and stronger, or Germany, where the AfD is getting stronger and stronger, I think it's a problem for the whole world. Autocracies get stronger and stronger because we Democrats give them the opportunities.
Because that's part of our system.
That's part of our value.
And it's the weakness.
Exactly. And they abuse this, they abuse our values as weakness, as our weakness.
Özkan Mutlu, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Özkan Mutlu is a former Green Party member of the German parliament. He spoke with Lekfex Bonnie North in Germany, where she is currently reporting as a part of a journalism fellowship through the RIAS Berlin Commission. You can find more coverage of Bonnie's fellowship abroad and a link to the blog she's writing on location at WUWM.com.
A quick break now, and then we go on an adventure with the help of the co-founder of Atlas Obscura. That's when Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect Weekend now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Even on the coldest and gloomiest of days in a city like Milwaukee, we can open a window on an exotic universe. With a computer or smartphone, that is. The internet has brought far-flung places and people closer together. And one of the go-to resources to find places to go to is the website and social media feed, Atlas Obscura.
The site connects travelers and would-be travelers with each other and with unique tourist attractions in all corners of the globe, 15,000 at last count. Atlas Obscura expanded to include a real atlas last year, and this month the Atlas Obscura Empire expanded again to include a book sharing unique places with a younger audience. And it all started here in the Midwest for co-founder Dylan Thuris. He was in Milwaukee recently and joined us on site at the Greenfield Public Library. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to chat.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So how and when were the seeds of adventure planted in you?
Yeah, so I credit these Midwestern road trips that I went on with my parents. So I grew up in Minneapolis, and you know, I didn't travel anywhere exotic as a kid at all. I think I made it to Canada by the time I was 13, you know? But my parents did take me on these very quintessential Midwestern trips where we would, you know, it was like 6 hours between locations. And we went to South Dakota and saw Wall Drug and the Corn Palace. And we went to North Dakota and saw relatives. And we went to Wisconsin. And I went to a place when I was about 12 that is still one of my favorite places in the world. It is in Spring Green, Wisconsin, and it is the House on the Rock. Well known, I think, to Wisconsinites, but I still credit it as one of America's weirdest places. It is truly amazing. And it's funny because it's a place that either at some point you are screaming for an exit, you're like, get me out of here. I was just talking to someone today who had that exact reaction to it. Or you're like, this is a wonderland. I can't believe how incredible it is. For me, it was like, this is a wonderland. And for those who've never been there, it's got the world's largest carousel inside of it. It's got a giant hallway that looks like it goes on forever and is kind of cantilevered out over the forest. It's got a squid fighting a whale the size of the Statue of Liberty inside of this house. It takes 6 hours to walk through. Anyway, so that sort of got that going in my mind. And then there were sort of a few other things along the way. I mean, I liked books about this kind of stuff. I think most kids do enjoy books about, you know, ancient cults and hidden wonders. I would look at those Time Life books called Mysteries of the Unknown. Yeah. They had those ads that said, read the book, which those were, you know, they're full of sketchy stuff, but they were still fun. And then as I got older, as I was more of a teenager, 15, 16, Minneapolis, I was a straight edger as a teenager, so I didn't drink and do drugs, but I spent a lot of time exploring abandoned buildings, and that was another way in which I sort of got acquainted with the joy of place and places having their own stories and personalities. So those all kind of, and at that point, obviously, Atlas Obscura was nothing. It's only in retrospect that I look back and I see these kinds of things, but those all sort of started some of those interests forming.
Well, right. I was reading this latest book through the filter of, you know, what I have enjoyed it when I was a kid. And I got to thinking, you know, kids collect stuff. You know, at least my kids collect stuff. I guess Your kids are probably, they maybe collect,
like,
you know,
acorn tops, right, and right, whatever they have in their pocket, the weird, like, Lint. Magical things in a 3.5-year-old's pockets are like, where did you get this? Anyway.
But the other thing they collect is cool experiences, you know? It's like, this book is really about collecting weird knowledge.
Yeah, and I think my hope is that for parents and kids together, it's a chance to just sort of go on this journey of imagination and curiosity and wonder in the world. And, you know, it's not a very practical trip planning book. You know, you're not going to go to Blood Falls in Antarctica. But each of these places, as you learn about them, hopefully it sort of expands your sense of what's possible in the world, how big our world is, how filled with sort of astonishing stuff and things still left to discover. I mean, the world's largest cave in Vietnam was discovered just a few years ago. And so this sense that there's still a lot out there and that we should approach the world with that sense of kind of wonder is what I hope people come away with.
Yeah, do you think there's a certain inherent optimism in travel and writing about far-flung places?
I think for what we do at Atlas Obscura, there's an inherent optimism. I think that the inherent optimism is that the world is a beautiful, magical place. And sometimes the things are dark or sort of you know, it's Skeleton Lake, and they were all killed in a hailstorm, and it's crazy. But it is sort of a reminder that our world is an amazing place. And I think sometimes our modern experience can feel very claustrophobic, and sort of this, the world actually doesn't feel big. It feels like, oh, there's a typhoon in the Philippines, and that's horrible, and whatever. But it all kind of draws close, and I hope that sort of pointing out some of the stuff that people aren't familiar with pushes that out a little bit and makes you feel like, oh, yeah, actually, I know so little, and there's so much for me to find in this world, and it's not even about going far away so much as approaching my own surroundings with that sense of questioning.
Right. I think when we're kids, we have this idea of just traveling the world and meeting people who are as nice as we are and having them expose us to the amazing things that they do when they come and visit. It's like, you know, pen pals in person.
Yeah. And I do think, I mean, there is something about travel. It's an excellent shortcut. Travel is just probably the most efficient shortcut to giving yourself new eyes, to seeing that world. So when you go somewhere new, you start to notice all these little things, like silly things, but you start to say, oh, the trash cans are different, and it's the streetlights work differently. And like that feeling when you kind of are, and it sort of brings you back into present attention, which you lose in your normal surroundings. And so it's just the fastest way to give yourself that sense of focused curiosity, I think. And that's just good for everyone. It expands people's perceptions, you know.
It was so cool, you know, reading this to see that you wrote about the fact that always used to blow my mind when I was young, and that was that South Africa has three capitals.
Yeah. So we filled the book with these like little obscure facts. Why was that the fact that blew your
mind? I don't
know.
You know, I do know. I know exactly why it was, because I was as a kid, it was still in the days where you could get a shortwave radio, and you know, it's so easy today. You turn on you go on your computer and you can dial up a radio station from wherever you want. But you know, I had a shortwave radio, and I found a radio station in South Africa, and they were giving the temperatures for different parts of the country, and they gave the temperature in Bloemfontein, which is I think how you say that. And so the next thing I did is I went to my world atlas and saw there it was, three cities in South Africa that each had the little capital symbol for them, and you know, down the rabbit hole I went.
Why shouldn't more places have multiple capitals?
I don't
you know, there's no good reason why you can only have one. We wanted the book to have a lot of these little kind of fun facts in them. We wanted to include some stuff that sort of was semi-practical. We talk about, a packing list and things like that. But a lot of it is imparting, like, the philosophy of Alice Obscura, how you look at the world. But
you're the gateway drug to the adult version.
Kind of, yeah. And we see them as sort of playing together nicely. Like, I think, you know, a savvy 11-year-old can take the sort of adult, you know, the book for adults and page through it and really enjoy it. And I think hopefully in the same way, an adult might be able to take this book and open it up to a page and get that same sense of wonder. But this, I do think this reaches an audience of 6, 7, 8-year-olds who the big book is sort of too much. It's too wordy. It's too much book. And this, because it's illustrated, I think it sort of plays in that space between the real and the fantastical, and it kind of captures some of the magic and wonder of the world from a kid's perspective, you know?
Right, and as you say, there's a lot in this that no kid is realistically going to travel to. They might travel to in their mind, but I wonder if the inspiration that this book provides is to just be adventurous in your travel. You know, it's, you know, you go to New York, you don't just seek out the Statue of Liberty. You look for those weird, you know, whatever the New York equivalent of the Snake Rodeo or Wall Drug is.
Right. And I think, like, I don't need to go to Snake Island to love the fact that there's an island with one snake for every 3 feet, and they hang from the trees, and they eat migratory birds, and they eat each other, and it, you know, that just, unsurprisingly, I'm an enormous nerd. I also love reading, you know, personally, fantasy, science fiction novels, and I love that sense of magic. And I think for me, a lot of what Atlas Obscura is about is trying to imbue our own world with that sense of magic and to see things. You know, when you look at bioluminescence in the world, when you look at fireflies or the larval fungus gnats in Watomo Caves in New Zealand, where it looks like this sort of constellation on the ceiling, that is magic. I mean, that is genuinely like ripped from the pages of a fantasy novel, because it, you know, our world has that kind of magic, but it we have to engage with it. Like, if we sort of like, yeah, I know, do you know what I mean? It's like, it's sort of a way to just remind, in a way, it's like, for me, it's a way to remind myself, like, stand still and see the wonder in front of your eyes, you know?
Well, and what better way to do that than to take your kids someplace and say, check this out.
Yeah, and it's funny because, like, my children are tiny, 3.5 and 16 months. But the one thing that has been fun, and when I say travel with them, sometimes that means, like, you know, to the park. The way they engage with their physical surroundings is hyper-present and hyper-tactile and hyper-focused. And God, what I would give to capture, to be able to really get, and so it's, you can get a little bit of it and you can try and put yourself in that place, but I've been trying, you know, to really, that, a child's sense of wonder and amazement in the world is like actually everything that this is for me, and to sort of try and capture, to hold on to that as much as you can as you grow up and become an adult and like have a job and car insurance and whatever.
Well, and I was thinking I was going to ask this question, you know, with a sense of irony, but, you know, often when we engage with the stuff that Atlas Obscura is doing, we're engaging at our desk in a cubicle someplace or on the couch or wherever else it is that we are on our screens. But at the same time, as you're saying this, it's a rare opportunity to be in our cubicle or on our couch or wherever and be amazed by something.
Yeah, and hopefully it like nudges you out the door a little bit. But I'll say this too, you know, sometimes the attention that you pay in your desk to something online, I'm thinking of particularly the story of a place called the Chicken Church in Indonesia. A guy got a vision, you know, sort of one of these like dream visions to build a giant chicken, well, it was supposed to be dove-shaped, non-denominational prayer house, but everyone calls it the Chicken Church because it looks like a chicken, and they all thought it was a Christian church because he's Christian. But anyway, he couldn't finish it. He ran out of money. It fell into disrepair. It was abandoned for years. In 2015, photos of this place start circulating online. Atlas Obscura, we didn't break the story, but we were sort of an early part of it. And so people start showing up. They go from being 10 people a week coming by and paying their dollar admission to being 100, 200, 1,000. Suddenly, there's money to support this thing. This guy, Daniel, who created it, is able to take that money, pour it back into the place, finish all these murals, set up the cafe and like the butt of the chicken where you can get some fried cassava. And he realized his dream because people were clicking around on their desks, you know, on interesting stuff on the internet, their desks. We live in such a weird interconnected world now, and so much of it is so gnarly. It's like, you know, content farms in Macedonia pumping out like, you know, right-wing memes. But there's another side to it. Sometimes like beautiful things happen. The chicken church like rises from the ashes, or the clown motel gets 100 bookings. You know, it's this place in Nevada. It's clown themed. You get it. Anyway, sometimes there are wonderful unintended consequences of our attention. So anyway, side note.
Well, the wonderful thing is that with this book, one imagines that this isn't going to end anytime soon.
No, I mean, and the newest thing that as a company we're doing, so Atlas Obscura, we have this database of 15,000 places all over the world. That's kind of at our core. We do a lot of original editorial reporting, interviewing. We do events. We have 9 event chapters around the country, but we've recently, in the last 3 years, started taking people on trips. So we bring groups of 15 all over the world to Bhutan, New Mexico City, to Antarctica, we haven't gone to Antarctica, into the Arctic, sorry. And you know, it's nice to be able to sort of put our money where our mouth is and say, okay, the world is full of wonders and now we can take you on a journey and contextualize the stuff you're seeing and tell you the stories that make you understand why it's wondrous and why it matters. I've always felt like that's often the problem with travel media, is it tends to be sort of like the nicest new vacation. You know, it's everyone's going to this beach or Iceland, hot new thing. And
we should note this book starts in Iceland.
I know it has Iceland in it. Iceland is like a truly magical place, but you know, it gets very repetitive and kind of in these narrow lanes, and like it's a big world. And often what makes a place wonderful is not that it's nice, like a lot of nice is good, but it's all of the stories and the context and the people and the culture and all of that. And so that's what I, you know, like to do.
Dylan Thuris, thank you so much.
Of course, thank you. It's great to talk to you.
Dylan Thuris is the co-founder of Atlas Obscura. We spoke with him at the Greenfield Public Library, where he recently talked about the book for younger readers he co-authored, The Atlas Obscura's Explorer's Guide for the World's Most Adventurous Kid. There's a link to the Atlas Obscura's list of 16 cool and unusual things to do in Milwaukee at WUWN.com.
We will take one last break and then have our storytelling series, Exfabula, Lake Effect Weekend returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Exfabula!
True personal story.
Exfabula!
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it is Exfabula Radio Time on 89.7 WUWM, part of Lake Effect Weekend every weekend. Good afternoon. I'm Bruce Winter. Leah Delaney is the co-founder of Milwaukee's Exfabula, and she is here every weekend as well, bringing us stories from Story Slams past. Exfabula now in its 10th season of Story Slams, and every week on the radio we have a certain theme that Leah brings to us. And this week, because October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, thought we'd go with that.
Yes, yeah, we certainly did. We did bring personal accounts of people's experiences with breast cancer. Our first storyteller for today's show is from our very first Story Slam event back in 2009, where the theme was beginnings. So let's listen to Leslie Biernat tell us her story.
I'm going to start first with, I was born December 26, 1969, but my real birth started April 15, 2003, and that's when I was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. That's when I learned how to live. All my life, we try to figure out what's our purpose, what's your passion. You know, I was going around living life. I was married. I had 2 small boys. They were age 8 and 6 at the time, and now I'm faced with this diagnosis. But you know what? It changed my life completely, and I'm going to tell you how. I used to be a nurse in the ER, worked there for about 7 years. And then I decided, you know, I don't want another woman to have to face this disease alone. I want to be able to help them. I want to inspire them. I want to motivate them to be more than they can be. So I changed careers, and I became a breast care coordinator at St. Luke's, where every day I'm privileged and honored to meet with these women face to face, and I can tell them, I'm your future. This is what you can look like. This is what you can be. I've been through chemotherapy. I had 6 rounds of chemo, spent my whole summer that way. The first thing I thought of when I found my tumor, I'll tell you, it was 6.5 centimeters large. I found it in the shower. And with now all the new guidelines coming out, well, I was on FM 106 this morning, radio, if any of you were up at 6:15 this morning. I was on there this morning giving my opinion on what I thought about those guidelines. I think they're ridiculous. I found my tumor, and I'm not even 40 yet. I'd be dead by the time I was 50. It was invasive cancer. It was in my lymph nodes. So chemotherapy came. I lost my hair. I don't look good bald. I'm tall. I'm very noticeable. I had to be a wig girl. I give credit for the women who can go without hair. I couldn't. I had a lumpectomy, I had 33 radiation treatments. I went back, I had a total mastectomy reconstruction, and a year after that I had to have a total hysterectomy because I had changes in my uterus. So now I'm on medication that keeps me from not having any hormones in my body at all, and I've been on there for about 7 years. I tell women I don't look like a man, I don't sound like a man, everything works properly, so don't have that fear of that. Everything's okay. So what I did is now I'm doing this job and I'm working with people. Well, then I wanted to go a little farther. And I said, you know, life's too short. I know how it is to, when people say smell the roses and stop and take your time and look at things. You know, I was truly blessed. God blessed me that day that I was given that diagnosis, because I was able to take life and just say, you know what, it is precious. And there are things that I want to do. There are goals and dreams that I have. And I can do them. And you can too. You may not have cancer, but what do you guys want to do? What have you always thought that you might want to achieve or try? Well, I'm type A personality, always been an athlete my whole life. So I said, you know what, I'll try some triathlons. Started doing the dance skin, the nice friendly one for the breast cancer survivors. Did that my first year after diagnosis. And I go, that wasn't good enough. I said, I wanted to show them that you can have strength and power and you can achieve goals, even though I've had muscles cut in my lats. So I went and did in 2008, I completed the Ford Ironman triathlon in Madison. And it took me 15 hours and 40 minutes, but my goal was just to finish it. Yeah. I talked along the way. I had my tri-bike wrapped in pink ribbons and had Survivor all of it. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'm doing pretty good. You know, I was already surviving, and this girl flies by me that's bald. And she's like, hey, rock on, I'm breast cancer too. She was in the middle of chemo, and I'm like, dang. All right, she's got me beat. I at least was done with that part of it. So finished that, got my little achievement, talked to everybody along the way. That's why it took me so long. I was just happy to survive and be able to walk and talk and breathe when I was done. Never ran a marathon in my life until that day. And then I finished that and I kept working. I go, what else do I want to do? Every year I set a goal and I set a challenge. And I challenge you all to do the same thing. It's kind of fun and people think you're crazy, but it gives you a purpose in life. So then I wanted to show them that there's beauty in scars. A lot of women are very self-conscious when they get breast cancer, if they've had mastectomy. I mean, reconstruction options are great, and nobody can donate fat. Everybody wants to donate their fat to make a boob, and you can't do that. It's got to be your own. But people still try. There's tons of great plastic surgeons out there today. So I'm like, I'm going to show them there's beauty in the scars and strength. So I started training. I'm a personal trainer, too. And so I started training for figure competition, which is above bikini but beyond gross, manly women, steroids. Okay, not that. All natural. I'm off season right now, so I'm a little plump right now. But I did a show in October, so that was my goal for 2009, was to compete. And you talk about dieting. I mean, that I should have wrote it, carb depleting, stay away from me, because you are not a happy person when you don't get carbs. I love my food. And believe me, I mean, I just had pizza. I just had a lot of pizza, and I'm going to pay for it. I'm doing another show in April, but that was my next goal, is to get up on stage in a tiny, tiny bikini in front of thousands of people and show them this is what you can do. You can achieve it even with the scars. So my next goal, it's always been a dream of mine, is to start my own foundation. And so that's what I'm going to do. And I've been wanting to do it for 3 or 4 years and just didn't know where to start. But God has placed a lot of people in my life right now, and he's telling me, you know, I like your inspirational stories and how you bring faith up. It's time. It's time for me to make a move. It's time for me to make a difference. And so I'm going to start a foundation called Renew, and it's going to be a place where women survivors can come and renew their mind, body, and spirit while remembering who they were before cancer, who they are now and through their journey, and who they can become. And it's based off the Bible verse Isaiah 40:31. And that's how I get renewed from. It says, those that hope in the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall run and not grow weary. Well, they shall soar on wings of eagles. They shall walk and not grow weary. They shall run and not grow faint. And that's what we as survivors do. We keep our hope. Never take their hope away from them. Never take your hope away from you. We have strength. There's power. We are together. You guys, what I ask you, in closing tonight, you know, what are your dreams? You know, what are your inspirations? What do you want to do? And then I ask you, what are you waiting for? Do it today, because nobody is guaranteed tomorrow.
And that was Leslie Biernett's story about her personal account with breast cancer.
It is, you know, I have a second birthday as well. It is May 10th. Because that was when I received the bone marrow transplant. It gave me a second chance at living, much like what she has gone through. And it's right, you have to set goals for yourself, although mine were much more modest than going out and running.
Was it just like turn the TV on today? Or?
Yeah, mine was, you know, be able to get back to work and get back to life as normal. Those were my goals. And, you know, those have been accomplished for several years now. But to go out and run a triathlon, no.
She's a serious warrior for sure.
Okay, yeah, absolutely.
Definitely appreciate her. So we have warrior stories coming up as well from one of our partners, co-MC Tiffany Miller, lovely lady, keeping her life blooming. She has an event every year. It's called Fight for a Funky Cure fundraiser. It's where her and her mother Wanda co-host an event. And this year it's going to be on October 6th. At the Company Brewing. There's going to be spoken word. There is a donation at the door, and all proceeds go to Cynthia's Breast Cancer Giving Circle. Such a great event. She does it every year. And also, speaking of stories, we have another story slam coming up, and this is going to be one of our non-competitive story slams for those who want to come and just share. You know, and that's going to be at Sugar Maple. It will be held on Tuesday, October 9th, and the theme for that night is Misunderstood. So you can bring your stories to that non-competitive event.
I like the non-competitive idea once in a while, that you can just come and share and not worry about having to be the best performer that night.
Right, yeah. Right. I think, you know, there's two types of storytellers.
Yeah.
One that really appreciates the drive and the competitive spirit of it all, and the others that just want to share, and sometimes a little bit of both. Yeah. So we appreciate everybody coming to share, and that's our part of our exclusivity that we try to keep going here in Milwaukee.
All right, second story.
We are going to roll into our second and final story of the day. Here is Sally Stern's story.
I'm happy to be here, my first time ever. For years and years I wanted to come. Years and years I wanted to come to this. And I came alone, and my daughter wouldn't come, and my brother wouldn't come, and nobody would come with me. I have to go everywhere alone. And if I manage to pull it off, which I did tonight, I'm so glad that I did. So I grew up in Milwaukee, born and raised in this town, and I never lived anywhere else. I grew up on Washington Park neighborhood, on Spalding Place. It's a little street near Washington Park, Sherman and Lisbon, actually. And my sisters and brothers and my mother and father, we had a great time. Everyone loved Milwaukee and still do. And I want to say regarding too much information, my daughter always says that, TMI. She always said it, and I never ever felt that I ever gave too much information on anything. But I'm a pretty good extemporaneous speaker, so I can go on and on. But regarding, I would just say, regarding the same sort of stories that these emergency situations occur, well, I can tell you, yes, I had a mammogram at Mount Sinai Hospital, I'll say a day ago, okay, or 2 days ago. And I felt sorry for the woman who was giving me the mammogram because I was sweating. Like I was just had waiting and waiting and waiting. It took so long for me, and I was sweating profusely. And they tell you not to wear deodorant. Okay. So you can't wear deodorant. So here, she's going, this woman who's giving it to me, I swear she was choking on the smell that was coming from me, the sweat. And so that's my story. I just want to tell you that's all for now.
And that was Sally Stern's a story about her waiting room experience.
Yeah, you know, I have some stories I could share about being hospitalized and all that kind of stuff. We'll save them for another time, but you've got to find humor in the situations, you know?
Sometimes you have to. Yeah. There's no other way. Yeah. The sense of humor. It's such a great tool to have in your toolbox.
Hey, remind us of that non-competitive story slam again.
Yeah. So it'll be held at Sugar Maple on Tuesday, October 9th. And Sugar Maple is in Bayview. We've been there many a time. Please get there early and get your tickets in advance due to the fact it is a smaller venue. But the theme for that night is misunderstood. Again, it's non-competitive. Let's sit around, have a beer, and tell stories. It's going to be awesome.
Sounds like a good time to me.
Yes.
And if you want to find these stories and share them and listen to them again, they are at WUWM.com and all things Xfabula
at xfabula.org.
Very good. And we'll be back next week.
Perfect.
Xfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tighe. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.